Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They're going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Because I used to observe that a lot of little shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out. Took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done.
Hmm.
I started coming along. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, it's MLK Day, and before we get to him, we have, just quick, we hit the title of today's podcast because we were off last week, but we started back up. We did something short on Saturday, just a few minutes, last night, and then, of course, our regular time, which we're on now, 10:30 a.m., 9:30 Central. But anyway, today's title, before we get to the MLK topic, which will probably be our main topic, but DIY, which that's the name change for us. It's my house. It's build it yourself shacks. And today we're going to just introduce the topic of mortgage awareness and the 40-hour house. And some of the things I have in the scrolling marquee, which is here on Blog Talk Radio, you know, mortgage. A lot of people don't realize what a mortgage truly is and how it can affect their personal finances. So some topics that we'll be discussing all through this week and wherever on in. The 40-hour week. Oh, wait a minute. Is somebody calling me? All right, no. The 40-hour, 40 hours versus 280 hours. Excuse me, 40 hours versus 2,080 hours. So the typical person that works 40 hours a week, 9 to 5, in the course of one work year, they've worked a total of 2,080 hours in a year. Over a 5-year period, they've worked 10,400 hours. All right. In the course of 10 years, they've worked 20,000 hours, 20,800 hours. In the course of 20 years, which is a career for some people, they've worked 41,600 hours. That's in 20 years. And if they work 30 years or if they've gotten a 30-year mortgage, that's 62,400 hours they have worked. All right. And we're introducing the 40-hour house because what we're saying is instead of getting a 30-year mortgage in which you're going to work 62,400 hours to pay for it, unless you have a side business or something like that, then wouldn't it be better to learn how to build something debt-free in 40 hours? So we'll be covering this, in, you know, every day this week and then at least once or twice a week. Matter of fact, at least once a week because we'll be building these structures and teaching people how to do this. So in any event, that's just a quick introduction on the 40-hour house, which is mortgage awareness. And then we'll build on that day by day this week. Today is Monday, MLK Day, federal holiday. So, Delmar, happy MLK Day. Delmar, you there?
Yes, sir. Morning.
Yeah, good morning. Happy MLK Day.
Yes, same back to you and to the audience.
All right. Well, Anything that you would like to share about MLK, Martin Luther King?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I think we should appreciate who he was as a man because he's a man of his time, and I don't think we have nothing since him. And now some more. He would be 95 today and lived. It's his 95th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But he left a legacy.
Oh, he would have been 95?
Yes, that's what they said on the news this morning. I didn't catch it, but I managed to get that right. But he left a legacy and a message for the rest of us. I believe it's worth anyone's time who wants to move forward as successful as you can be. Take a look at this man's character and what he stood for, and that he was unique in that he had talents and abilities that I believe God gave him, and he used them at a point in his life when he felt it was threatened. He still stood his ground, and when he finished what he started to do. So I think this government that they recognize this day, as they have many other men, I just hope that we as a black community would take the time to see what he represented and the message he left for us here today. In fact, I think someone made the phrase of still building the dream might be something to think about going forward. We're still building the dream. I have a dream, he said. So we still need to build that dream. Got another generation of young folks need to know what that is. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Martin Luther King, he was born in 1929. And he was just with us for 39 years. And let's see. some of his influences, if we read here on Wikipedia, were Mahatma Gandhi, Abraham Lincoln, and this is a person I'm not familiar with, but Delmo, you might be Bayard. What's this guy's name? Bayard Rustin. And
I believe I heard a kid right now at the kick, but I think I remember that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bayard Rustin. Well, the civil rights, they had several people that. But anyway, but this guy was one of the influences on MLK. See, Bayard Rustin was born 1912, transitioned 1987 when he was 75, was an African-American leader in the social movements for civil rights, socialism, nonviolence, and gay rights. Okay, I didn't know that was even on the table back then. Rustin worked in 1941 with A. Philip Randolph on the March on Washington movement. I never heard of it classified as a movement, but it was a movement.
Yes, that's the guy I remember, yeah. I read that.
Okay. For the press to an end to racial discrimination in the military and defense employment, Rustin later organized Freedom Rides and helped organize the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to strengthen Martin Luther King Jr.'s leadership. He taught King about nonviolence. In 1953, Rustin served as principal organizer for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So I've always heard of the March on Washington, but I never heard the complete title. So the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom.
See, that was the economic aspect of the fell through the crack.
Okay. Now, but now right with here. The Nation of Islam, now the Nation of Islam which they were not high profile during that period of time. But now they were always preaching but they were preaching entrepreneurship, do for self.
Right.
Sure. But not everybody's cut out for that. So. All right, Rustin worked alongside Ella Baker. Now, Ella Baker, from what I heard, she was really the primary architect of the civil rights movement. We'll get back to her in a moment. She was co-director for the Crusade for Citizenship in 1954 before the Montgomery bus boycott. He helped organize a group. And friends, you know what, let me ask you something. Obviously, during the civil rights movement, a lot of black folks, I mean, they did some successful organizing. And not only that, they studied, I mean, I'm just giving it from my point of view. They studied how local, state, and federal governments worked, and they got in. Because, like, the five largest, most populated cities in the United States, all New York City, Los Angeles, California, Houston, Texas, Chicago, Illinois, there's one more, Houston, Texas, I say, if I didn't repeat that already. But all five of those currently have a black mayor. So there was some fruit as a result of the civil rights movement. But Delmar, what do you? Well, let me ask. How can I phrase this? Do you think that we can organize that on an entrepreneurial level?
Man,
blacks becoming business owners on a mass level.
I think we need to look at the context of things that were done back then.
Uh-huh.
And before I comment on that, we'll go back to you name some other people that we don't hear a whole lot about, but the lady that's involved.
Yeah, Ella Baker. Yeah.
Yeah. King wasn't the originator of the civil rights, nor was he the master planner, but he was the spokesman. He had
right.
this gift of speech. He had this ability to put words together and then move people. But the other
right.
men that had the ideas, but they couldn't get over. He had that gift of getting that thing over in a way that folks got up and moved. And of course, he was a leader. Now, he was out front. He wasn't in the back telling people what to all
no.
do. led. So that's one point to keep in mind. He was the mouthpiece. He had that gift of speech.
That is true. That is true. You remove him out of the picture, it wouldn't be the same as it ended up to be.
All right. Now, back to your question. Again, the setting of that time, the reason blacks often succeeded in establishing some things, as you say, in the city of Atlanta and the places, is because segregation, you might say the civil line of rights of segregation might have been a unity that it forced black people to have. What the man wouldn't let us do, we did for ourselves.
Right.
And that created a culture of self-sufficiency that was strong. Again, I grew up in Mount Bayou umbrella area. I know that. But when that was removed and then we were told you can go anywhere and do anything a man has, we left that unity and that independence and got, to my opinion, we were caught up in the man's dream of what success is.
Right.
And oftentimes that's a trap that sucks us in and puts us in a bondage of artificial sense of success and prosperity, which, again, enslaves us to the job. And we spend all the years, 40 years, all the hours, trying to have something that really is, in terms of actually having it, is an illusion. That 30-year house isn't the 30-year house, isn't the house you start out with. So, we had the context of opportunity, and together we became strong and thrived, as with, if you look at Tulsa. Tulsa was not integrated. It was a period of segregation when they did all that. But they were strong through that. So, now the question, I don't see us having the motive to be together that we need. We have
right.
So many blacks. We have gone out and achieved so much in music and entertainment and politics on their own without black unity. But we don't have the incentive, in my opinion, to do that. We still have the ability and the opportunity there, and some are doing it. But I don't hear or know of the black leaders, the voice, the spokesperson, or the program, the project. I heard of people, us getting together and talking about what we could do and what could possible, but I don't know and have heard any one leader or a message that says, this is it, and here we're going to do. Getting back to Islam and some others, God and others, who many times what they taught was had an element of that didn't appeal to other folks that may have discriminated or pointed out some things about some other folks. There may be some negative tone in there. And much of Islam has been, again, used to push the hate for the man.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't go over well with the media. They didn't promote what he was saying and doing because of that element, in my opinion. Yeah. So to answer your question, we still have the ability and the opportunity. I don't think we have the message or the messenger or the focus plan, made the focus motivation. That there were so many things we were being denied during the days of King's time. We couldn't even go to the library, couldn't even go to the studio. There's just so many restrictions, and we were paying for those things. We paid taxes and all that. And now we believe we have everything. Where can we want that the man has? Yeah. So where is the motive for us to do for ourselves and become independent that we could be? And I think until that is crystallized and made a motivating, driving campaign, I don't see us doing what we could. And so, but the tiny house, yeah.
Right.
That's an opportunity. That's something we're gonna push. And maybe the conditions, the timing, the things that are happening right now, the economics, the homelessness, and my immigrants, all that might become part of the grit that we put together and have this movement successful for those who choose to do it.
Okay. All right. Let me see. I remember, after the assassination of Martin Luther King and things settled down a little bit, because I was living in Washington, D.C. during that time period, my mother took me down to Resurrection City. Matter of fact, I'm going to see if they have anything online about that, Resurrection City. Poor People's Campaign. Let's see. Remembering Resurrection City. All right, yeah, they do have something on it. 1968. All right, Poor People's Campaign. This was not hold. The one I went to was after King was assassinated. Let me see. That was 1968. Yeah, they set up shop on the Washington Mall. I remember it was real muddy down. Okay, Memphis. Well, matter of fact, now, Delmar, you're in Memphis. I just ran across something, the Memphis sanitation strike. What do you remember about that?
Interesting, the last survivor of that strike just died last week. He was 92 years of age. Last person. Again, that was typical, you might say, situation. Dr. King came here to get involved in because the sanitation workers were, of course, from a social standpoint, they were at the bottom of the ladder and wasn't being paid or treated or whatever, even with worse type of conditions. And Dr. King came in to address that. Of course, you may remember the motto, a theme of that movie was, I'm a man, because they were treating the sanitation workers like they weren't in. They weren't human. I remember the mayor at the time, the whole administration their Jim Crow racism wasn't here. It was public.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a downright period of oppression that was outward. Of course, Dr. King came in and exposed that with much of his leadership and ability to frame an idea and to speak it and get it over. Now, by the way, today they have a civil rights movement, civil rights museum here planned, but this city has been snowed in and shut down. Nothing happened today because the weather came in with 3 or 4 inches of snow, and Memphis is just not prepared for that, so there's not much activity. In fact, they're telling people to stay home, really, because the roads are so bad. No, but back to that, yeah, the sanitation was quite a transitional time in the civil rights movement, not only in the end of his life, but the call, it was a bottom of the social ladder. These were sanitation workers who were underpaid, work condition, everything was the worst that you want to find. And they were, I think, all black men. And they were treated for less being less. And that's why you see in the picture now, they say, I am a man, what they march with. Because they were not treated like they were men.
Well, now, I found what I was looking for Resurrection City. It says here, and this is right after the assassination of Martin Luther King. On Tuesday, May 21st, 1968, thousands of poor people set up a shanty town known as Resurrection City, which existed for 6 weeks, and the city had its own zip code, which was 213. The city initially scrambled to build shelters to meet the basic needs of the initial 3,000 residents. Many people volunteered to help construct the shelters for the campaign's Building and Structures Committee, chaired by University of Maryland's architect John Wevenson. the group struggled in choosing a name and a location for the demonstration and did not decide on Resurrection City and the National Mall until 2 days before the arrival of the marchers. In exchange for a permit, the camp on most of the most famous strip of grass in the United States, the campaign agreed to limit the city to 3,000 people for 36 days. Under leadership of Walter Reuther, the United Auto Workers donated $55,000 to support the establishment of Resurrection City. The group was, of course, poor to begin with, and now had gambled to on survival in a strange environment. Let's see. There was flooding there. Okay, activity, everyday life. Yeah, my mother took me to see this. All right, on Thursday, June 20th, police, well, anyway, the National Park Service evicted them. Aftermath. An economic bill of rights was never passed. And let me go to that economic bill of rights. Okay, here was the economic bill of rights, which was not passed. And this came from, I guess, the civil rights, let's see, Rustin Bayard, I guess, organized this. On June the 5th, activist Bayard Rustin had drafted an economic bill of rights, which he published in the New York Times with more specific aims, intended to convince the middle class and labor groups to support the action. Rustin suggested that the federal government should, and I'll name them, there's five of them in this economic bill of rights, recommit to the Full Employment Act of 1946 and legislate the immediate creation of at least 1 million socially useful career jobs in public service. Okay. Number two, adopt the pending Housing and Urban Development Act of 1968. Number three, repeal the 90th Congress punitive welfare restrictions in the Social Security, in 1967 Social Security Act. Number four, extend to all farm workers the right guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act to organize agricultural labor unions. And number five, restore budget cuts for bilingual education, Head Start, Summer Jobs, Economic Recovery Act, Elementary and Secondary Education Acts. And was there something else here? Okay. Now, the committee demanded an economic bill of rights with five planks or platforms. Number one, have a meaningful job at a living wage, whatever that was back then. Number two, secure an adequate income for those unable to find or do a job. Number three, access to land for economic reasons. Number four, access to capital for poor people and minorities to promote their own businesses. And number five, ability for ordinary people to play a truly significant role in the government. All right, well, let's start with five on this economic bill of rights. We've got a black vice president. We've had twice elected black president of the United States, black first family during that 8 years. The five most populated cities in the United States today in 2024 all have black mayors. And there are black mayors in other cities as well of sizable populations, as well as councilmen and aldermen and the like. We do have black congressmen. There's never been a whole lot of black senators. We've had black governors. Definitely have black entrepreneurs. So I would say number five, what's your take on that? I think we've made some major progress in that area.
Read it again. I got a comment. Read it again. I want to
Okay. Well, number five, the ability for ordinary people to play a truly significant role in government. Do you think we've achieved that in 2024?
Well, we have definitely, as you say, achieved the positions, but I'm not so sure that we actually had the influence that position perhaps should have provided. Remember that one of the things about the government now, money is the bottom line. You know, once the election, everything that happened now is that this dollar just driving. And right now, this coming up Friday, I believe we got the government budget that shut down and face again. We got to call another agreement on the budget to keep going forward.
Right.
Think about that now. Well, since when? I mean, now we're talking about government can't even run because we probably know how much money we put in. So it has changed significantly from that time. I mean, you had no discussion back then about inflation and problems mm-hmm. like that and the cost of
yeah.
nothing. And then 6-8. There wasn't even either gas, what, 60-something? Gas less than a quarter gallon? I mean,
yeah.
all this kind of thing. So it's an entirely different economic context. And so they have black people in positions who don't have the funding. Look at the man in New York with the migrant situation. In
mm-hmm.
Chicago, the money is just not there for many reasons. Also, politics is determining that. So, yeah, we have achieved some significant position in politics. But some of the other elements that are necessary to get the job done is not the same. And one more thing, lest I fall into the same thing of what you when you see on the media, when you see people sitting around discussing what's going on. And the founding fathers knew this. Dr. King knew it. We're never going to get there without God. All these solutions without God, it's never going to work. You just don't have the right ingredients. It's just not
right.
some ideas. The founding fathers recognized all the laws were grown up without God as an integral part of his presence. It wasn't going to work. And we're seeing that right now that you don't hear any solution to any problem that includes God's statement. Not there. It's almost there. More people pushing to keep God out than including anything. So there are so many things that are different than we were back then as a people. Even black community, we were more spiritual minded in the 60s. Dr. King was a spiritual leader. He was a preacher. He didn't apologize for it. He never did just try to be a politician. He refused to be a politician. He was a man of God. He has a message. His whole idea about justice was from God, not from man. We don't have that concept there. That context is not, that's not a part of the context. You hear people up pleading the cause of humanity, they do not include a spiritual reference to it.
Okay, now, let's see the next point, point four, out of the committee that demanded economic bill of rights, this goes back to 1968, access to capital, well, let me phrase it this way. Well, let me reread it as it is and then phrase the question. Access to capital for poor people and minorities to promote their own business. So, Delmar, do you think that black folks have achieved that we have access to capital? Or this is poor people. This doesn't put a race on it. It says, because the March on Washington was a poor people's campaign, regardless
right.
of race. All right. So let me correct that. Right. Access to capital for poor people and minorities to promote their own businesses. Well, I think that's a vague statement because, you can pool money together on a private level among friends and family, or churches can do it, small businesses can do it.
Was this
so
a question?
We have the capital.
Huh? Were they saying the government? Wasn't they saying the government?
No, this says what they were in this economic bill of rights, and I guess they were trying to get some legislation. This never made it now, but it says in this particular request, access to capital for poor people and minorities to promote their own businesses. So I'm taking for granted maybe they're talking about banks.
Well, remember SBA, Small Business Administration? SBA, Small Business Administration.
Right, that's true. Small Business Administration.
And I attended those. I had a store at the time myself, a grocery store. I went to some of the workshops. And the idea there was to, again, help these small guys understand some things that he needs to know and how to go about achieving some things under that program. But you also found out, though, even though that idea was for, like we said, the poor, the average guy, I never forget during that time, that was a year when, you ever heard of Dr. J? Of course you have.
Basketball. Yeah.
He got a loan from SBA for distributing Dr. Pepper. But when found that, which is still true, if you got money, you get money. Pepper had money. He didn't have no problem getting that SBA loan because of his stature and what he had.
Right.
If you go to that being a nobody and nothing, by the way, remember this too, I found this out. Although these programs had a government heading, they were still carried out by local financial institutions. They were still making the last decision. Even the what's that home loan thing? All those things you got the first thing to tell you, no, this government don't do nothing. They don't loan no money.
Right. They just insure it,
They pretty much promoted it and say they would back it up, but again, you had to have the same requirement. Otherwise, if you got it, you could have got it without anyway.
Right.
You had the qualification to get through that process, you could have got it anyway. Because all these finance institutions, they said you got to have collateral.
Right.
And they say banks, and they don't risk that money. They ain't going to take no loss. They want some kind of guarantee to fall back on that says when the dust settles, they came out in black. And many times.
Now the next request here is access to land for economic reasons. Now that's a mystery to me because, but now you might know something I don't know, I'm sure. Because I'm thinking about there were a number of black townships that had been around for quite a number of years prior to the March on Washington, which they had, I mean, nobody talks about, at least back then, they really weren't talking about it. They really don't talk about it today.
That's right.
So,
you know, I talked about that. That's right.
Right. So I imagine, let me ask you this. Was Jim Crow, not Jim Crow, the lynchings and the racial violence and then you had the sundown towns where certain black families were forced off their land. And that land could be 500 acres to 1,000 acres or more.
Right.
What Mose Wright, who was Emmett Till's uncle, he had 25 acres of land. 25 acres of land, and he grew cotton, which was a cash crop. After he testified at, Emmett Till's, the trial.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He left money in Mississippi. So my question is, who got control of that 25? Matter of fact, that's my theory. I tell it about once every year or so. I have a theory about the Emmett Till thing, which they say that was the spark of the civil rights movement. I believe Emmett Till was not the intended target. I believe Emmett Till was used as a ruse, and the intended target was Mose Wright, not so much to kill Mose Wright, but to get that 25 acres of land that had the cash crop of cotton. I believe that was the real motivation. But Mose Wright was also a preacher or a pastor in money in Mississippi. And once again, I'm speculating. This is just L.A.'s pure speculation, okay? But they were trying to get a hold of that 25 acres that he had with the cash crop. And but he was high profile in money, Mississippi. He had a certain amount of respect and money, Mississippi. So I believe that they just didn't know how they can get a hold of that 25 acres of land with a cash crop of cotton on it. So, okay, I'm listening. So Emmett Till, when they kidnapped him, Emmett had only been there for like five. I don't even think he was there a week. I mean, that incident happened within no more than 7 days of Emmett arriving in Money, Mississippi. When they came knocking on the door to get Emmett, okay, Emmett's wife, Emmett's aunt, Mose Wright's, his uncle's wife, she left the next day. She got out of Dodge. The two sons, they had two sons, they left Money, Mississippi. So Mose Wright was the only one that stayed behind, and he stayed for the trial, and he pointed out the two guys who, you know, did it, and who admitted that they did it to Life magazine or Look magazine, you know, after the fact of the trial, where they couldn't be tried for double jeopardy. So the question that I ask is nobody. Whatever happened to that 25 acres of land that had cotton on it that was ready to harvest? Because Mose Wright didn't stick around to harvest anything. He left and never came back. So therefore, I think the whole Emmett Till thing, Emmett was used as a ruse to get at that 25 acres of land. Anyway, that's okay. Just a theory of mine.
Now, let me get where I leave some real salt to what you're saying.
Okay.
Again, not only do we leave God out of the situation, we leave the presence of darkness out of it. As you say, surely the higher motive or the bigger gain was the underlying that. Land was always a primary item that people fought and died over.
Right.
So anything that could be done, if there was an opportunity to seize some land or resources, which was cotton, poor. Mm-hmm. Yes, that became the underlying thing they wanted to accomplish. So getting rid of blacks any way they could was done. Now, the men who may have went in and got tear and did it, so they may not have had the high motive you just mentioned. But other folks saw, hey, with these folks out the way, that land they can't take with them, that you say, and they didn't. Therefore,
right.
Who you think, you say, who moved in on it? No blacks stepped in there and said, we're going to take this land over. No. Everybody was scared. Man, said scared.
Oh, yeah. After that, high profile.
And no white man had ever been convicted for doing anything to black man. That's why those guys wasn't worried about confessing, admitting it. No jury had ever convicted a white man ever of doing anything to black man. So they had total confidence that they were going to walk just like everybody else.
Right.
And remind me of the movie that you watched, the movie Time to Kill, Samuel Jackson?
Okay.
Again, that was just a pattern that, hey, those guys are going to walk. Everybody knew it. And nothing going to do about it. That's why in the movie Time to Kill, Jackson killed the guy. because he knew, hey, they're going to drive, they're going to walk. So I was just a part of the process, but they're not going to be done to it. So back to the thing, yes, that land, they didn't take it with them, and like I said, they didn't let their cotton sit out there and rot in the field. Processing, somebody got the money.
Oh, yeah.
And
somebody
who's going to jump up there and say, I'm going to claim this, I'm going to, no. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because once that land was left.
As far as the two guys who, you know, did the kidnapping and killing of Emmett Till, talk about bad karma. That store eventually went out of business, and those two were ostracized. They were shunned by other white people in that town. And they left the state of, you know, Mississippi, and tried to have some luck in Texas or somewhere else. That didn't work out for them. Then they came back, but even white folks in town, they shunned them. But now a big part of that, I believe, was with Emmett Till's mother. I got to watch that movie that they made last year. But with Emmett Till's mother in association with Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, Ebony was up because they moved his body to Chicago. So that's where he was from, Chicago.
That's it.
Right.
That's
so when Jet, you know, put it out there for the world, well, let's get started with when his mother had an open casket.
That's right. That's right. That's
pure genius on her part.
That's right. And when all blacks had been killed, it was just a hush-hush thing. Nobody heard it. Wasn't publicity. Just a novelty. They heard about it, but so what? They hung or they did this, beat them up. But like you say, and not only this was a kid, this was an innocent child.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reason the pushback is so great. You know, doing stuff to grown men is one thing. Took a child.
Yeah, he was only 15 years old. He was just 15.
15?
Yeah, a kid. Yeah.
Oh, young. Yeah, anyway, so I think I was 13. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that her decision to open that casket was a thing that made it explode because she had never seen a mutilated body like that, a child. In that context of why it was done and what he had done nothing. And
right. That's
what made it stick. So that was one kind of media made the right decision.
Right. Well, like I said, Johnson with Ebony and Jet Magazine, they took it, you know, it came out, and then the mainstream press came on it right after that, and which I'm glad they did. But you're right, because my grandmother said if the Mississippi River could speak, anybody who came up through that era, because this thing dealt with access to land and economic uses. So you had a lot of people left, like my father, my biological father. Now he was originally from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Okay. And now the reason why he had to go up north is because, now I just heard this from the grapevine. I didn't hear it from him, from my mother. But I heard he beat up a white man in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. So that's why he had to get out of the state. I heard that from other cousins and whatnot, so that, you know, knew him real well. But
you remember that the state boundary just meant the line on map. They weren't restricted to what each state did. You couldn't do something Mississippi and run over Arkansas. Well, I mean Arkansas. I mean nothing.
Right, that's true.
The line that says you cross the boundary, but those folks that live on both sides, Mississippi, Alabama, that's all the same folks.
Same people.
They used to call Memphis up in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Now, with those family members out of Pine Bluff, that's where my father, he had to leave the state of Arkansas. Now, he went, he ended up in D.C. because that's where I was born. But we had a branch. We got a branch that's up in Milwaukee, Detroit, and oh, this is with my family on the father's side of the family. So you had a lot of blacks. I mean, all right, put it this way: after he did what he did, okay, him and I got three other cousins. They left. They left farmland behind. Now, how many acres they
That's
left
right.
behind? I
That's
don't
right.
know. You know.
But then,
I can't blame them. I can't blame them because it. You know what? This is crazy. I don't want to laugh. But now, when I came up, because I'm 66, when I came up, I had fights with white kids in third, fourth, fifth grade and junior high school. I didn't think nothing of it. I won some fights. I lost some fights. But just to conceive, my father, once again, I'm hearing this from other relatives older than me. And they why he had to leave Little Rock, Arkansas, because they told me just like this, he beat up a white man. He had to leave the state. So that's why he left. And whatever family house or acres or whatever, he had to leave all that behind. And so then you got the sundown towns and all that. I can't even fathom that. But I didn't live during that time.
But it was known, you just remember, it was known that when that kind of edict went down, you had to go. They wasn't going to rest until they got you. There wasn't no law to protect you. You couldn't
right.
go to the law and say they're going to do it to you. Or after they did it, there was no punishment. So fleeing for your life and all the options you had. Couldn't just shoot out like the guy in Walker would shoot. I wanted to shoot out so I'm free.
Uh-huh. And even my, I know several years ago, she's passed over now, Aunt Lily B., They went from Arkansas up to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where the lion's share of those Davises, their family tree branch, is still up near Milwaukee. But I remember, now we went to visit her in Milwaukee, and then she did something, and I'm glad she did, I took it for granted at first, but now I can really appreciate it. She made us all lunches so we wouldn't have to stop on the road other than for gas and a bathroom. That was it.
Well,
now, I had that experience. Drinks, fried chicken, potato salad, the whole, you know, because we went from from Milwaukee, back to Detroit, I was like in my 30s then, okay. So, but as the years went by, then I started hearing stories about that was customary of blacks doing that, because at a time when it wasn't safe to stop on a highway.
You remember the Green Book? Hear about that one?
I heard about the Green Book. I've seen it, you know, pictures of it, and I know they got a movie about it. But now I can really appreciate that. But Aunt Lily B. Davis, that was her name. She looked out for us, man. And at her house in Milwaukee, she had a family tree. I mean, I don't know how far she went to school, but she was good at numbers. But I'll never forget that she hooked, you didn't have to, and it was good food, but there was a whole generation of people, generations that did that.
Yeah, come on now, that's the only kind of food we fix.
Well,
we could, good food back then. I mean, folks could.
We only stopped maybe one or two times, bathroom and gas, that was it.
Yep. And now you say I travel quite a bit. I love now when you stop at a rest stop now, which is paid for by taxpayer, which is us. Man,
right.
You can really appreciate some of these places. Any truck stop, man, they are really something nice. And that's what you
Well,
thinking.
Yeah, they are. They are, and I've done my share of road work myself. But you know what? Going back, the food that was prepared in black households for those road trips is healthier because a lot of people, you know, a lot of truckers, you know, if you're eating on a run like that and you're getting all this processed food instead of home-cooked food, you know, you know, I had a cousin, he was a trucker, and, man, he passed away. I don't know if he was even 40 years old yet. But now you take somebody like Pleasant. I imagine Pleasant probably had a lot of home-cooked meals that he took with him. You know, I don't know, you know him a lot better than I do. But, no. You think he was eating on the run a lot?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's anywhere. He has family all over the country. He's from Arkansas.
Okay.
He's unique in a lot of ways. He still is. But, yeah, he's...
All right. Well, he's still with us.
Yeah, like you said, processed food was fattening. And some in the truck, heavy built, heavyweight, they're sitting there riding, but the food
right.
is not being, or carrot not being burned. But they do have
right.
an appetite, and they had good food on stop there, man, just smack down. Like I have a cousin, he told me, they always had cash money, and there was a place that you couldn't eat.
Right.
Stop in here and eat your soul because the company made sure you eat that food to keep driving. But never had a problem having enough food to eat.
Well, anything else about MLK, Martin Luther King, and because it's so much that he did or, you know, the ripple effect. It's somewhere on YouTube where, you know, he did have the vision where the United States would get a first black president. I don't have that queued up, but I'll see if I can get it on by tomorrow, Wednesday. So we've had Barack Obama elected twice. We have a VP that's a black woman. So we got a call here. Happy MLK Day, area code 410 Beasley. Good morning.
Good morning, Brother L.A. and all of your guests. Hotep. Hello.
Hotep.
Are you familiar with the black lieutenant governor in North Carolina?
I believe so. If he's been in office for the last 2 or 3 years, yeah. Isn't he a Republican?
Yeah, a black conservative.
Yeah. I'm familiar with him. I've heard him speak, via video on YouTube 2 or 3 times, though. That's all.
Did you hear what he said about Martin Luther King?
No, I did not.
He really trashes Martin Luther King.
Uh-oh.
He really just says a lot of vile disgusting things about Martin Luther King. And the thing is, I'm wondering if that is the mindset of black conservatives like him. Because the thing is, he claims that everything wrong with the society is because of Martin Luther King. I'm paraphrasing.
Right. Mark Robinson, that's his name.
He is a very disgusting, sick of a human being. I didn't know whether you'd ever heard any.
I never heard. I've seen him speak. It was a couple of years ago. Just videos on YouTube, but, I don't follow him. He's 55 years old. He was born in Greensboro. Let's see.
What's your politics?
Well, he's a Republican.
Black conservative Republican.
Well, he'd have to say that he's keeping power base, wouldn't he? Wouldn't he have to say that he's keeping power base going?
Go ahead,
Beasley.
No, go ahead.
All right, I just found a headline on the Huffington Post. MLK, oh, let me open this up so I don't want to think, say nothing out of context. All right. MLK, oh, top GOP. I'm looking for the, I got to find something that he said. MLK.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see, MLK, somebody hopping, all right, here, I think, all right, I want to make sure this is right, so, all right, the headline says, people, now this is, I'm not saying this, I'm reading this off Yahoo News. The headline says, MLK was an inferior pastor and communist, said top GOP candidate for North Carolina governor. Okay. Martin Luther King, now the article says, this is on Yahoo, this is not LA's opinion, people. Martin Luther King Jr. was just a pastor and communist, and the 1960s civil rights movement was crap. Now that's the word that's in this article, according to a series of Facebook posts by Mark Robinson, the leading Republican candidate to be North Carolina's next governor. And he's already lieutenant governor, if I'm correct, Beasley, right? He's a lieutenant governor already, right?
Right.
Okay. Robinson, who is currently the state's lieutenant governor, regularly criticized King and the civil rights movement for years on Facebook, specifically on MLK Day. Huffington Post found an AMIT review of his post. The black politician also downplayed slavery, rejected the idea that he's part of the African American community, and attacked the late congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. These posts are surfacing at a time when Robinson, who is on track to be the GOP nominee for governor in November, has been trying to soften his rhetoric and celebrate King and the civil rights movement. Last month, former President Donald Trump hailed Robinson as better than Dr. Martin Luther King at a campaign event, and Robinson responded by saying he took it as a compliment, and knowing what I know about him and the history of those are big shoes to fill. His social media posts tell a different story. In January 2018, Robinson mocked people who celebrate King, who said that he was just a subpar pastor. He didn't mention King by name, but he was clearly talking about the civil rights leader in a series of messages posted on MLK Day that year. It was once funny and said that so many people will follow the lead of a bunch of atheists and worship pastor as a deity. Robinson used MLK Day to dismiss the idea that racism is real. Boy, this is super conservative here.
I know it's not.
That's the Prince of Darkness. He said light is darkness, darkness light. That's not direct. There ain't nothing new about that. That's what I'm saying. You take God out, this being surfaces himself, and he don't hold back nothing. You don't pretend. That's right. I'm not surprised you see.
Well, Beaver, there's a bunch of North Carolina, I don't know what the statistics are, I have to look it up. There's a lot of black folks that live in North Carolina.
That's true.
All my kids are born in Carolina. Yeah, go ahead.
I want, man, this dude coming out with this kind of rhetoric. I can't see him winning, but I don't know nothing about North Carolina politics or nothing like that.
Well, if Trump can do what he's doing, saying why, that's the gateway. Anybody can come after that and then make some put it, especially in the same party. No problem black men to come behind there.
Well, the deal is this, and I would lose money on it. He's going to lose just on the strength of the white vote, because it's hard for black politicians to win statewide offices.
Right.
Governors and senators, you can't win a statewide election if you're black. You can't do that. And what he's doing is he's trying to appeal to the lowest of the low to try and gain favor with white folks, because he's not going to get a lot of black votes. I can tell you that now.
Not talking that crazy talk.
well, black folks didn't put him in as lieutenant governor either. You know, but the thing is this: you know, based on just numbers alone, white folks are not going to vote for him. And then he's a Republican too. So would that be in the case? No. But, you know, the thing is this. We have a lot of ungrateful black people that can look back on history now and say, hey, what I would have done and what I wouldn't do and all of this other foolishness, not knowing what you and the gentleman that's on this podcast has stated. The situation in the 30s, well, starting from 1865 all the way up to 1965.
Uh-huh.
This country still hadn't abolished slavery. I'm 74 years old. When I was born in 1949, you can do the math. Well, let's do it this way. We've only been out of slavery, what, 100 plus years, right?
It hasn't been long.
You got some people that's 90-something years old right now. So with that being the case, 1865 to 1900, you figure, what, blacks had been out of slavery only 35 years. And you can add 49 years. You can add 1949 to that. That would be what? Maybe 84 years? So when I was born, black folks had only been out of slavery 84 years. So if you subtract 2003 from 1865, I think that'll give you, what, about 137 years, won't it?
It's not long. You're right, it's not long.
138 years. So what's happening is we just got the right to vote with the 1965 Voters' Rights Act to protect us to vote. So we've only been able to vote without threat of bodily harm or death since, what, 1965. And then this fool is going to go up there and see all of that crazy stuff. That goes to show you that he's not aware of our history. And like you was just stating a few minutes ago, hey, black folks, when they were traveling long distances, our folks would fix them basket lunches to make sure that they had enough to eat along the highway. And look, you were very fortunate if you didn't have to go in the woods in between those trips and do what you needed to do to relieve your body.
Right.
Or take a leak or either, you know, do your business or what have you. And then while you were traveling, if you had out-of-state license plates, they stop you just on GP and give you a ticket for a little bit of nothing. So when you have a person like this gentleman I have referred you to, you know, it's shameful that he would get up just for a few votes and make the remarks about Martin Luther King, someone that's really responsible for him even holding office, being able to run
exactly.
For office.
Exactly.
And then he's going to do. And look, I can say that about a whole lot of black conservatives and a whole lot of, and some liberals that talk that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it's just shameful that our people don't realize the sacrifice that Martin Luther King and his family made that we can talk here today and really have some sense of security.
Yeah, well, security and free speech. We can say what we want to hear right here.
Well, free speech.
We don't have to worry about nobody taking us away. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, you and the gentleman on the other line, I mean, I don't know how old he is, but I'm old enough to remember that if you were walking on the sidewalk and a white person was coming your way, you had to get off on the curb and let them walk by. Even if there was a mud puddle there, you had to get off on the curb. I know. Say again.
78. I'm facing.
Oh well, you know.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well,
I lived it down here.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, white folks really could do anything, and well, they almost can do that now. But they could really make you do anything you wanted to do, and you didn't have the power to really. Defend yourself against him.
Right.
You know what I mean? So when this guy gets up, he only says that in front of white officers. He can't come out in the public square and say a word.
Well, you know, with that kind of talk he's talking, I'd be afraid to walk out. Man, I'm assuming he's got bodyguards because his inflammatory speech, somebody could go off on him. I'm sure he's walking around with bodyguards with talking that kind of talk.
Well, you know, we're peaceful people.
I agree. Keep in mind now, Trump opened up a whole era of the people coming out. They people didn't just get like that after he spoke. They were already had that in them. He's just become the mouthpiece for all this hatred that been there for all these years suppressed. And it wasn't proper to say it, but when a man of his stature gets to there and say, I can shoot somebody on Main Street and nothing happened by it, and now he claimed that I have immunity to do anything I want to do because I'm president, that kind of talk emboldened other people to come out and say what they're saying. That's what this black guy is thinking. Man, if he can do that, I can say this too. That's the core. That's the atmosphere that's going on right now. It wasn't out there in 28 when Obama was elected. Because we didn't have anybody like Trump saying this stuff and getting away with it, in my opinion.
And look, him labeling Martin Luther King as a communist, a lot of black folks don't know the origin of why a lot of civil rights leaders were labeled as communists. Well, the reason why...
That was J. Edgar Hoover's main speech against King his day. He tried to undermine everything King said by saying he was a communist. In fact, I told you, I was in a white college, and that's what they said in there. I was the only black student in my class that King was a communist. I told him I quit and cursed, I told him all and left, quit school. Anyway, that was common. That was a common thing that day that King was a communist. They tried to come to white people, tried to come to black church and present that stuff. And they called a rift in the community even worse. When they go, we're going to come and show y'all this stuff about him. We said, get out of here. Church or not. Anyway, I mean, cut y'all, brother. Go ahead.
Well, the reason why they label civil rights leaders and some members of the NAACP as communists is because what happened is the Communist Party really was, they had a little power in the United States in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And what the Communist Party proposed to do was to take the United States to the World Court, United Nations for human rights violations. And what happened is a lot of blacks supported the communists in that move. In fact, a lot of lawyers coming out of Howard supported that move. And the thing is, anybody that challenged the Jim Crow segregation system at that time was labeled a communist. And then when you were labeled a communist, that was almost like a death mark against you. That was a scarlet letter against you. But the main reason why it started was because the Communist Party, in order to gain influence among black people, was to go in and start the process to file human rights violations in the United Nations against the against the United States government. And that's where that came from. But Martin Luther King was not a communist, nor the civil rights leaders at that time were communists. But, you know, the white society would use any means necessary to try and stop black folks' progress, and that was one of the key things that they could use during that time, because the Red Scare during the 50s under McCarthy was really in its heyday. And that was one way that they could go in and smear black leaders of that time that was trying to fight for our, I guess, what do you call it, consumer rights and accommodation rights. But, you know, I got to take my head off to Martin Luther King. He sacrificed a lot. His family sacrificed a lot. And I don't know why we don't give this day more honor than we do. But, you know, we black folks, we're just like hogs. You know, as long as the slop keeps coming, we never look up and realize where it's coming from. But the thing is, that man made a hell of a sacrifice for us.
He did.
Sure did.
Right. Yeah.
Well, now, the hotel where he was assassinated, they turned that into a museum or just the room where he was at?
No, it's a museum right now. It's open today, but like I said, we got snowed out. They had a special program today.
It snowed? I didn't know it snowed in Memphis. Okay.
Memphis shut down, man. Memphis shut down. They tell everybody stay at home. Anybody out there but the police and the social, or what they call workers.
Yeah, emergency road people.
Right. They'll be there with about Wednesday, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the Lorraine Motel, was it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a museum now, the whole thing, or just those rooms?
They've kind of renovated to some extent. They did some things to make it fit, accommodate what you want here.
Yeah, it's a museum.
It's free today, but the weather shut that up.
Okay, well, I imagine it's a tourist attraction year-round.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Memphis, Vegas.
Yeah, if you're going
now,
to Memphis,
was it owned by black folks? I'm taking a granted it was.
You
I think it was.
Yeah, that's so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where he stayed. That was his accommodation.
Yeah.
Right.
But, L.A., you got to realize, and I don't know if this gentleman on the other end will agree with me, in your major cities, blacks did have places for you to stay, Roman houses and hotels. I know over here,
they did, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and if you look at
go ahead, Beasley.
No, go ahead.
Well, Delmar,
no,
I wasn't saying anything. Delmar, go ahead. You
no, I
part.
Just said nice place. Yeah, go ahead. I'm agreeing with you. Yeah, go ahead, Beasley, sir.
Yeah, I knew a guy in my community. He was a professional gambler. That's all he did was just get on the railroad and go from different towns and just gamble. He was a high stakes gambler. And he said whenever he went into a black town, all he asked for was where was the railroad track? Because he knew he could cross the railroad track and get anything he wanted. As far as whatever, you know, he liked to do. He could get a hotel room, he could get a girl. He could go and go to speakeasies and party and do all of this stuff in restaurants. And he said just about every town he went in, he could find a hotel or a boarding house. So with that being the case, that Green Book did list a lot of places where you could go and get a hotel accommodation. So if anything that you can take away from the integration movement was that, you know, we black folks, because of lack of identity, didn't support the things that we did have to make sure that, hey, we had the services that we needed while we were traveling. But that's just like the hotel there in New York, what, the Teresa Hotel in New York, in Harlem? That was black. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure in Atlanta they had a bunch. And I know in Birmingham, was the A.G. Gaston had a hotel, didn't he? So with
In Alabama, yeah, he did.
Yeah. And you can go a whole lot of other places, and they'll tell you that they had places where blacks could stay. You just had to get there, you know, because, hey, traveling up and down the highway in those days was just like being in a war zone. You didn't know whether your life was going to be spared or not. I mean, I may be exaggerating a lot, but it was very dangerous traveling up and down these highways in the 50s and
60s. I believe it. Go ahead, Delma.
You need to know where to stop. You need to know where to stop and where not to. That's what you need to know. And that's what the Green Book helped. But these, LA and I brought this up earlier. During the period of Jim Crow, as it was just the life, that we stuck together. Segregation forced a unity we had that was strong. We had strong families and all of those things. But once integration came in, we have been, assimilated so badly now. It's really hard to find us doing the things that we could do together. And this scattering of us, and in fact, the thing we could do is what Booker T. Washington talked about. We have lost men, though, because of the integration of philosophy. Everybody go out and get what you want it, so they can give it to the man guy. And like you said, places we had that were owned and supported by us, many of those places were going down because we quit supporting them. That's what happened to Mount Baggy. We left Mount Baggy. We left it.
Yes.
Man didn't drive out. We left.
Yeah.
Well, there was enough people in Mount Baggy to keep it, though, because it's still intact, Mount Baggy. That's good.
Yeah. And you know, who's on the other end, Mr. Delmar?
Yeah, Delmar, yeah.
Mr. Delmar, I think, and, you know, Brother L.A. and Yaki and all the rest of us on these airwaves over time have disputed about this. What happened is out of slavery, our people had a sense of identity. If you look at all of the institutions that we had, organizations that we had, they had African as part of their name. And the thing is, what happened is over time, we lost pride in our race. So when somebody did come along with this integrationist idea, we didn't have pride in our race to say, well, you know what? Hey, look, yeah, we can go over there, but we need to keep our stuff here. Now, the one organization that did stick with their identity was our churches, our denominations. Now, the thing is, the AMEZ and the AME, COGIC, and the Colored Methodist Episcopal organizations, if there's one thing that kept their identity and organized around their identity was our religious organizations. But everything else, everybody just flocked over to across the railroad track. But the thing is, that's where we lost it. We didn't teach pride in our race. Because, hey, look, all the other ethnic groups, you know, could integrate too. But the thing is, the Chinese and all the rest of them, they stayed in their neighborhoods and built their neighborhoods. We didn't.
That's right.
Because we just didn't have pride in our race. And that's the root cause of our problem now. Because when you have pride in your race, that means you're going to do all of those things to make sure that race survives. You know, it's a travesty and it's a shame that you can go in big black neighborhoods or neighborhoods in general and don't find a grocery store. Because that's a basic necessity for life.
Food, food deserts, as they call them.
What
makes me feel angry about that again, but I own one. But anyway, as I said, in Chicago where I live, that black people, we run corporate America. There's no image you can't manage. We got black folks in there running, and yet we can't run a local grocery store. That's crazy. We can't have our own grocery store in our community. We run everything else, but not that.
And then when we do put up stuff, our people don't take pride in having it in our neighborhoods. They'll go in and act all foolish and everything else and try and take stuff out of there without paying for it and everything else. But now my thing is, I don't know how long you've lived in Chicago, but look, Chicago had one of the biggest black Wall Streets in the country. What was it, Brownsville, ever what it was called? And the thing is, those people didn't have to go outside of their community for anything. But the thing is, we just lost pride in our race. All you got to do is look at this gentleman in North Carolina. Ain't no way in the world a self-respecting black person would be saying the things about his race or her race that he's saying. And we have a lieutenant governor in Virginia the same way, black lieutenant governor. And we have a lot of liberals and we have a lot of black conservatives and black liberals that is almost just as bad as he is. They'll say anything takes.
In Illinois, I got a black woman lieutenant governor. She's not that way, I'm afraid. She's holding the court. She represents us. That's good.
I think blacks in Chicago might be a little bit more sophisticated. Chicago, I would say Chicago
is strong black.
Particularly when it comes from entrepreneurship, Chicago, I think, has an edge on other cities.
It's strongly black. It has a black leadership in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Reverend Jackson, some of that credit. But, yeah, it's strongly in Chicago than you might find anywhere else, but still there's some weaknesses. Now, I just lived there. I just lived for a while, so I spent some years, so I'm not a Chicagoan. I'm back home here. But they have some black leaders that have held the line as far as maintaining some of the things that the pure symbol of black stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like I said, L.A., you know, Mr. Pleasant, he's a definite black man, and still is, so... And I like what you said about the churches. I came through the civil rights transition. I tried to do the integration thing, but I learned better, went to a white school and all that stuff. But I see now that's one of the mistakes. Trying to assimilate into another race, like I said, we probably tried it more than anybody else. But we need, as you say, to maintain our own credibility for who we are. And did begin, God made us black, and that's where we all stay.
Well, there's a saying, you may not acknowledge what your color is, but everybody else identifies with you by that. And with that being said, if you look at what we have as a group of people in this country, the assets that we're not utilizing. We have the power and the potential to dominate this society. I mean, if you just look at the things we do and the foolishness that we're doing, I mean, everybody knows the potential and the power that we have at our disposal if we just focus on utilizing it. But I'm just telling you now, that you can't do it without an identity. You just can't do it. And it's somewhere down the line, we're going to have to bring that back in order for our survival, because when you look at the immigrants coming in here, and if you're in Chicago, you know the deal, and you look at what's happening and where they're placing those people, if we don't do something real soon to gather ourselves together emotionally and physically and economically, I don't see us surviving to the year 2050. I just don't see it. Our children are going to be in trouble.
Well, you're right. There are more blacks in this country than there are for the entire population of Canada, exceeding it by 2 million people. There are 2 million more black people in the United States than the entire nation of Canada. So we've got the numbers. We have the money. We have the brain power. But I guess, like you said, we don't have the identity, at least on a mass level.
Well, as Sherry Elliott, I just moved back to Memphis. The community in Memphis were predominantly blacks. They're known. Everybody knew them by name. The Hispanics are moving in there, and they are dominating. As you're saying, if we don't stop and occupy, those neighborhoods used to be black will be Hispanic neighborhoods, because they're moving in there as families, building, rehabbing houses and all that stuff. That's right.
Mm.
If we don't turn it around, they will be the one in charge of the same community used to be us. It'd be them.
Well, yeah, like we were talking about earlier, you got this wave of immigrants coming in because you got Ukrainians, you got Syrians, you got Venezuelans. The Ukrainian I know. I know of her. She's a tenant of a friend of mine. Now, he's a black landlord, and he used to work in Russia for the State Department or something like that, because he can speak Russian and Ukrainian. So she has been in this country less than 2 years. She works 7 days a week. She now has her first car. She couldn't afford a car in Ukraine. She's 46 years old. So she's doing well with the American, what she's getting over here so far. So I imagine we're going to start hearing probably in about a year some success stories where these people have come over from these countries and become millionaires.
I'm not concerned with the individual. I'm not concerned with the individual being successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned with the whole race being in a position to do for themselves. Now, we have a lot of success stories in the black race in this country. I mean, the increase in black millionaires, I mean, if you look at the statistics, I mean, nobody can beat the black millionaires in this society. The number of black millionaires from the last census to the present upcoming census. But the thing is, us as a whole, people as a whole, that's where we lack it. Because now look, most of the chief export in this country is rap. What is that? That's a $20 or $30 billion business.
Clothes and everything's associated with rap and hip hop. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So I mean, and look, that was started with a turntable and a bunch of people out there just rapping over music. And you can look at a whole lot of other industries that, hey, look, depend on us for our dollar. So with that being the case, what you said is true. We have people in key industries. We have people in the entertainment field, and we have people in politics. But we just don't have that focus to go in and do what we need to do. Now, I sent Brother L.A. a map showing these sanctuary cities. When these, what was it, about a month ago, they had 7,000 Hispanics coming up to the border.
Right.
Nobody has said where those 7,000 Hispanics went at when they got to the border. And where they go at is to those sanctuary cities, where those sanctuary cities is where a large number of blacks are. And the thing is, there was a Undersecretary of Housing in the Herbert Walker Bush administration. And she said there was a meeting that the Democrats and the Republicans had to reduce the number of blacks in this country and bring in Hispanics to replace those numbers. Well, they can't get those numbers like they did in the 1900s, where they had all of those white immigrants coming over here to boost their numbers, because the European whites are, I think they're at what, less than a zero in producing enough whites to repopulate their cities and their nations. They can't get them from there. So where do they get enough whites to come in to keep this country as the third largest population on the planet? They have to go to the white Hispanics down south. So that being the case, what they've done is they put us on birth control and abortion, and they're filling in the numbers that we're not producing with white Hispanics. Because once they get to the border, you don't know where they're going at. But Abbott and DeSantis showed us what they're doing with those populations. They sent a whole busload, a couple of busloads of white Hispanics up there to Chicago, didn't they? Delmar?
Delmar.
And they sent a whole bunch of them to New York. And God knows how many is in L.A. Because the thing is, if you look at it, blacks in L.A.
D.C., they sent them to D.C. as well.
And Baltimore.
They got a lot
so
in
now,
D.C. They got them in New York City.
Yeah. They got them, and they got some over in Charlotte and Atlanta. So it's a plan. And the thing is, we're sitting back and we're fussing over politics and all this other crazy mess and pop culture while we're slowly being replaced. And we're being, and they're practicing genocide on us with birth control. So with that being the case, I'm saying in 2050, it might be over for our children.
Well, Dr. Claude Anderson's been, for a number of years, been saying we need to pull it together before it's too late.
Well, my thought on that, Milan, is, again, oftentimes when you promote black unity, people will accuse you of being racist. But I believe that, but not because of the segregated negativity that went with the Jim Crow segregation we came through. Other races come together, and they're not accused of promoting themselves above other races. They recognize, like you're saying, that the strongest people in this country, those cultures where those people are still together in this country, they just try and not trying to assimilate into no other group. So, yes, we need to come back together again and practice the unity we had when we were forced to. But this time it's a system, it's a plan, because we understand if we don't do that, we're going to be so assimilated that we won't have any power at all. That's my thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I'm going to let you have the last word. Go ahead, Beaver.
Tell Mr. Delmar what my definition for racism is, if you have time. Tell him what my definition is.
Well, no, I'm going to let you tell it. So you get it fresh from the horse's mouth.
Mr. Delmar, the reason why black folks are losing is because we don't practice racism. And I tell L.A. all the time.
He's got a unique definition of racism, though. He's got a very unique definition.
I'm listening. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Racism is a one-word synonym, which means a word can replace another word and have the same meaning. It's a synonym for self-preservation and survival of the fittest laws of nature. And every racial ethnic group on the planet practices it except black folk. And and look, self-preservation means that, hey, you go in and you make sure that you provide those basic things that you need, food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and health care, and you defend your right to go in and make sure you gather that for yourself. And self-preservation, survival of the fittest means that all those things that you need to promote and protect your self-preservation is to go in and make sure that you reproduce everything in excess. That means your population, your industries, and your ability to defend yourself to make sure that you as a race or species survive. That's what racism is. And look, black folks don't practice it, and that's why we lose.
I agree. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the best definition of racism I've heard.
It's positive, too. It's positive.
And it's very, it's nature-based. It's nature-based.
Yeah. Well, and look, guess who they say is the biggest racist in the United States?
Oh,
Louis
Farrakhan
and the Nation of Islam. They practice all of those things, and they call them reverse racists. Well, if you're reverse racist, that means that you're reversing the racism that's against you. So I get off and let you guys have a good Martin Luther King.
Well, no, we're time's up here today because we're going overtime, and this is the first time because, you know, Blog Talk had a lot of issues in December and part of this month. Like the first day of this month. But anyway, so we were off for like a week until we got everything straight. So we'll be back tomorrow. Everybody have a happy MLK Day. Talk to you guys later.